It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore more than 60 drinks over the years that have achieved a status of being a modern classic. And what elevates a cocktail to be destined for the ages? Join in on mixed drinks that have a long history at the bar, the Manhattan, daiquiris, margaritas, Wisconsin's version of the old-fashioned, the presentation, the precision in cocktail recipes. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Simonson is here, writes about cocktails, spirits, bars, and bartenders for the New York Times. His new book is called Modern Classic Cocktails, 60-plus stories and recipes from the new golden age in drinks. Robert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be here. Hello.
Hello. So you spent a lot of time with this question. So let's just go after it right out of the gate. What makes a cocktail a modern classic?
Yes. So a modern classic obviously is from modern times. I'm talking pretty much about the last 20 to 25 years, which is the era of the cocktail revival that we've all been enjoying for some time. And we differentiate it from a classic, which are the drinks that we all know, like martinis and Manhattans and old fashions and Negronis. They were invented 100 years ago or more. So when I started writing this book, I had to think, well, not only what are the modern classics, but why are they modern classics? So I came up with this kind of list of rules, this list of criteria. So the main one, the big one is, if you invent an original drink, and like, as I said, hundreds of original drinks have been invented over the past 20 years, it has to travel. It can't just stay in the bar where it was invented. It has to start being made at other bars. Other bartenders and bar owners have to see that it's a good drink, respect it, think it might be popular, and put it on the menu. That's the main thing. Another criteria is it has to be simple. If the drink isn't simple to make, it's not going to travel very far because it's just too much hassle for other bars to put together. So these modern classics are usually 3 ingredients, 4 ingredients. They don't have any special or hard to find things in them. Hmm. And of course, it has to be popular with the public.
People have to order it. People have to ask for it, right?
That's right. If nobody asks for it, it's going to die on the vine.
It's interesting, too, how you bring up the advent of the internet in helping these cocktails spread. What impact did that have?
Well, in the old days, in the 19th century, for a cocktail to travel, it really had to be word of mouth. So like a guy might have a drink, you know, that he liked in New York, and then he traveled to San Francisco and 6 months later asked for that drink. So it was very slow. But the cocktail revival actually paralleled almost exactly the rise of the internet. So with the internet, you know, you started getting chat rooms, you know, little corners of the internet where like-minded people could discuss things that they were passionate about. So all the cocktail enthusiasts and the cocktail bartenders got together in like the early aughts and would hash out these problems and also share recipes. So that helped spread the word really quickly.
And you also detail this 2007 to 2012 time frame when you call it like this embarrassment of cocktail riches. What was happening in that time? Because, you know, look at the economy. I mean, we were really struggling, in that era.
Well, a number of things happened at the same time. It was kind of a perfect storm. Number one, people started opening bars that concentrated on cocktails as opposed to being all around bars. They made a very specific showcase of cocktails. Another thing that happened were there were certain bartenders who were coming up, young people. They decided to concentrate on this area of drinking and really try to figure out how to make these cocktails well. And they found a safe haven in these bars. Then there was the internet where people were sharing ideas. And also a lot of ingredients that had been lost to time started to come back on the market, lost liqueurs and neglected spirits like rye. And rye had not been drunk for a long time. It came back. And mezcal, things like that.
We're talking about this renaissance of modern cocktail invention. Robert Simonson, our guide, he's written about drinks and cocktails for years. New book is called Modern Classic Cocktails. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Okay, Robert, heavy hitting question here. What is Wisconsin's modern classic cocktail?
A modern classic cocktail from Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer for that one. The cocktail revival primarily happened in the aughts in three cities, London, San Francisco, and New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just natural because those are kind of media centers. So if cocktails are being invented and a new exciting bar is opening, it's going to get written about. It's a little harder for other markets. But Wisconsin, you know, should be proud of itself as far as cocktails are concerned. It was kind of one a cocktail incubator in the later part of the 20th century when a lot of the world had forgotten about cocktails and wasn't really drinking them so much. Wisconsin was still doing so, most famously with the brandy old fashioned.
And that was the follow up. You know, why does Wisconsin's old fashioned ditch the conventional way you make it? I mean, we swap our whiskey for a brandy based mixture. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's a complicated answer. Wisconsin has been drinking its old fashions with brandy for at least a century. There is this theory that the Korbel brothers, who made wine out in California, debuted their brandy at the Chicago World's Fair in the late 19th century. A lot of people from Wisconsin went down to that fair and they brought back that taste with them. But there are other things working here. There obviously is a large German heritage in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And when the German people came to Wisconsin, they brought their drinking habits with them, which was not just making beer. They also made their own brandy. They made a lot of their own spirits. And so that taste for brandy was kind of instilled in the nation. And there's a commercial reason, too. During the 30s and 40s, the California brandy makers, the domestic brandy makers, advertised heavily in the state. And I think that took root.
When did fruit hit the old-fashioned?
You mean the muddled fruit at the bottom
of
that?
Yeah, right, right.
That's a bit of a mystery. It happened during Prohibition. Some people say that during Prohibition, people were drinking very bad quality spirits, you know, unaged spirits probably. And so in order to make the drinks taste better, they may have introduced fruit into the drinks. And then that masked the terrible taste of the whiskey. But one thing's for sure, the muddled fruit did not exist before Prohibition. After Prohibition, however, muddled fruit was everywhere. And that's pretty much the standard. And I say about 80 to 90% of bars serve old fashions today.
Longtime cocktail writer Robert Simonson is taking us on a tour through classic cocktails. New book is called Modern Classic Cocktails. Join in with questions on how to make a good cocktail, the garnishes that help inform every sip, the stirring, the shaking techniques. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent as we explore a cocktail renaissance and the creativity of bartenders through time who developed classic recipes played on variations of old standards with mixed drinks that have stood the test of time. Join in on what you consider a modern classic cocktail. Tips on cocktail recipes to make at home over the holidays. 800-642-1234. Robert Simonson's new book includes dozens of cocktails and the stories behind them. It's called Modern Classic Cocktails, and he stays with us. Robert, you've said presentation and precision go a long way toward making a good cocktail. What equipment should we invest in? What should we have on hand to make these cocktails?
Yes, it's kind of funny. I mean, you wouldn't think you would need so many things just to make a cocktail at home, but actually it's a fairly decent list of equipment. There are two kinds of cocktails. There are the kinds that you stir. Those are made entirely of alcohol, and there are the kinds that you shake. Those have juice in them or dairy or sometimes an egg. So you'll need a cocktail shaker. If you get like a Boston shaker, that's kind of like a metal tin with a glass shaker glass on top. Mm-hmm. That'll serve for almost any drink that you want to make. You should get a bar spoon to stir things. You need a strainer so that if you have a shaken drink, you can strain out all the juice pulp or whatever else might be in there. I mean, those are the beginnings of what you would need in a bar. Yeah, you'd be surprised once the cocktail bug bites you. You end up buying more and more equipment. It's like suddenly I'm
sure
this
that's never happened to you.
That. Yeah, my bar is pretty crowded with things and gadgets and gizmos.
Do different glasses serve a purpose, or are the glasses just for looks?
I'd say both. There okay. are certain glasses that are dedicated to certain drinks. There is, of course, the old fashioned glass, which is also called a rocks glass. Tom Collins is usually put in a Collins glass, which is also called a highball. Margaritas have glasses named after them. Hurricanes named glasses after them. I mean, obviously, you can put these drinks in any glass you happen to have. If you have a wine glass or a water glass at home and you don't have the proper glass, that's fine. It's probably going to taste the same. But part of the fun of cocktails is the presentation. I mean, if you go to a nice cocktail bar, you'll notice that the bartender took a lot of time. He wanted it to look good. There's an expression in the bar world, you drink first with your eyes.
What about ice? Does the type of ice you use in a cocktail matter?
Yes, it does matter quite a bit. Quality ice, I mean, first of all, there's aesthetics. So like if, for instance, again, you get an old fashioned and some of these nice bars will have like a single clear cube, and that's quite beautiful to look at. Also, when you're shaking up the cocktail, if you have low quality ice, I mean, some of the ice machines that are out there, they produce a very kind of thin, fragile cube, and it melts very quickly. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get a more diluted drink if you use that kind of ice. So ice does make a big difference. If you're making cocktails at home, I would recommend changing your ice cube trays fairly often, because ice will attract the other flavors of the things that are in the freezer, and that may affect the taste of your drink.
I've always wondered if there's a way to replicate the ice that you see in bars, that really clear ice, if you have any tricks there.
That's very difficult. I mean, they actually use some very expensive ice machines. And if you're seeing those clear cubes,
yes,
chances are they've been carved out of a large piece of ice, you know, that could measure like 6 feet by 3 feet. But you can buy ice molds that create larger cubes. It won't be a clear cube, mm-hmm. but it will be that large format cube. Those are easy to find in almost any store now.
How do you suggest making cocktails for a larger group of people to serve at a social setting?
Yes, that's a good question. I would suggest you can batch cocktails beforehand. Mm-hmm. Probably not a good idea to do shaken drinks. Shaken drinks sort of have to be done on the spot, or else they're just not going to taste the same and the citrus and the spirit are going to separate. But things like martinis and Negronis, you can whip up a batch of that, put them in a pitcher, you know, cover it, put it in the fridge or the freezer beforehand. And then when people want them, you just pour it into the glass.
So, you know, I'm wondering how long should you, as you've got all this equipment, how long should you shake or should you stir? Is that intuitive or can you do that prescriptive through a recipe?
I try to be very specific in the recipes in the book because you don't want to leave anything to chance. I think with stirring or shaking, about 15 seconds will do it. I mean, if it's a little less than that, that's fine. You want to accomplish two things when you're shaking or stirring. First of all, you want to get the drink cold, obviously. Mm-hmm. And cocktails need to be cold. If you've ever had a lukewarm cocktail, you know that does not taste good. And you need that dilution. Most people don't think about this, but water is a big part of cocktails. A lot of people order drinks, and the definition of a good drink is a strong drink. But if you don't have water as part of your martini or your Manhattan, it's going to be too strong. It's going to be too harsh. So any good cocktail, I'd say about a quarter of that is probably water.
How do you feel about cocktail mixers or cocktail syrup? Because, of course, those formulas will also dictate how your drink is going to taste. But what are your thoughts there on those pre-mixed type packages?
Yeah, we have a lot more of those now than we used to. It was common in like the 50s and 60s. A lot of mixers and bottle form came out, and the idea was convenience. You know, convenience was the preeminent wish of, you know, households back then. But now they're coming back. The pandemic had something to do with that. When the pandemic came, everybody was trapped at home for a while. They were quarantining, and they had to make their own drinks. They couldn't go out to bars and get them anymore. So everybody kind of trained themselves again. The cocktail hour had kind of disappeared, and it came back. So a lot of people saw an opportunity there. We got a lot of canned cocktails, a lot of bottled cocktails, a lot of bottled syrups and things like that. Just as with anything, there are good ones and there are bad ones. I tend to like to make cocktails from scratch. I think it makes a difference, just as it does with baking and cooking. There's a thing called simple syrup, which is an ingredient for many cocktails, which is basically sugar water. It's 50% water and 50% sugar. It's not very hard to make, so I don't know why you would go out and buy a bottle of that. Now, other things are more difficult, like, you know, grenadine, things like that, orgeat. And so some of them are quite good, and I do use some of them.
Robert Simonson with us, author of 6 books on cocktails. Latest one is Modern Classic Cocktails. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You identify the Oaxaca Old Fashioned as signifying the peak of New York City's cocktail revival. Can you explain this drink and why it took off?
Yeah, this is basically an old fashioned. And instead of whiskey, it has agave spirits. It has tequila and mezcal. And it was created in 2007 by a guy named Phil Ward. Back then, I'm sure it's true in Wisconsin as well. Mezcal is an extremely popular spirit. People are drinking it all over the place. But back then, not many people were drinking it. It was kind of a forbidding liquor. If you knew about it at all, it was that strange bottle behind the bar that had a worm at the bottom of it. And people were scared of it. You know, it just looked like hangover in a bottle. But what the case was, is they just had not had any good mezcal. So around the late aughts, some good quality mezcal started coming on the market, and this bartender started playing around with it. And a good way to create a modern classic is to take a classic and just change it a little bit. So he took an old-fashioned, very simple recipe, took out the whiskey and put in tequila and mezcal, and presto chango, he had a new drink. And it tasted fantastic and different and yet familiar. The structure was familiar, so he could put it in front of a customer and they wouldn't be too alarmed. That drink took off really quickly. And because it was so simple, it was copied by a lot of bars. And now it's such a classic that the bar that where it was invented at a bar called Death and Company in New York. They actually have a t-shirt that says Oaxaca, home of the Oaxaca Old Fashioned, on it.
What is the difference between mezcal and tequila?
Well, tequila is basically a specific form of mezcal. All mezcals are distilled from the agave plant in Mexico, and there are many different kinds, species of agave. And so you can make mezcal from many brands of tequila, of agave. But tequila is specifically made in only certain regions of Mexico, and it has to be made from the blue agave plant. So tequila is just one kind of mezcal.
What impact did the drink have on the cocktail scene in the years that have followed? What has caused bartenders to really pick up on it?
Well, it had a very big impact, and it was a very simple impact. It showed all other bartenders that I can mix cocktails with mezcal. Prior to that, if you drank mezcal at all, you drank it by itself. You either sipped at it or you had it as a shot. But the idea of using it in the same way that you use gin or whiskey to mix up a cocktail, that was a revelation. That was new information. The book that I wrote previous to this one was called Mezcal and Tequila Cocktails. I wrote that because suddenly there were hundreds upon hundreds of agave cocktails out there, and I just wanted to collect a whole bunch of them. And it really is kind of, it was kind of miraculous.
Let's just pause right there with Robert Simonson on Modern Classic Cocktails. You can join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are on a tour of classic cocktails in the bartender community in the early aughts that author Robert Simonson says created an embarrassment of liquid riches destined for the ages. Join in on a mixed drink that you have improvised on, mocktails, cocktails, and the drink you think Wisconsin is famous for, 800-642-1234. Robert Simonson's new book is called Modern Classic Cocktails, and he stays with us. Let's bring in Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi there.
Hi. Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. So I've had a couple two true old fashions in my day, but I had this interesting observation where it's like, yes, from the ones that I've made, and I used to work as a bartender at the union once upon a time, but it's like the, I guess, sort of the traditional method of making an old-fashioned, you know, requires brandy or, if you're of another persuasion, whiskey, and then, of course, the two cherries, the orange slices, at least one of which gets smashed, and then, you know, a sweet or sour flavoring. And so there's that, but then there's also type of old-fashioned had at various establishments where it's like, I guess, a more expensive or cultured variety of cherry and then an orange rind. And so it's a slightly different consistency. It's more of a higher-end, you know, kind of a newer type of cocktail blend of old-fashioned. But I wonder if that's something that maybe came out of this new wave of, I guess, cocktail craze, or I guess both styles have existed for a long time, but it's just one of them, like, kind of has this distinction of being higher end. And so I just wondered what was with that, if your guest had any insight.
Jack, thank you. The garnishings, Robert.
Yes, no, it's a very good question, a good topic, one of my favorite topics. My first cocktail book actually was called The Old Fashioned, and it was a whole book just about the history of the old fashioned. So what Jack's talking about, the original Old Fashioned, and the full name of that drink was the Old Fashioned Whiskey Cocktail, was a very simple drink. There was just a little sugar, some bitters, a little water, and whiskey, and an orange twist on ice. That was it. After Prohibition, we got the muddled fruit. So it actually became a much more complicated drink after Prohibition. It was sort of like a glass of punch, individual glass of punch. And that's the way it stayed pretty much until the year 2000. With the cocktail revival, a lot of the young bartenders, they went back to the old models. They studied the old books, and they discovered the old-fashioned used to be made in this much more simpler way. So if you go to some of the more modern bars or the fancier cocktail bars, that's how you're going to get your old-fashioned. But most of the bars still make it in the muddled way. So right now we live in a world where we have these two versions of the old fashions, and you can pretty much get the one that you like.
Jack, thank you so much for the question. Ronnie now in Portage. Ronnie, hi.
Hello. I'd like to hear a comment about the optical illusion that bars and restaurants create by using thicker glasses with higher bottoms and always keeping it full of ice after you mix the drink in. If you take that ice out, you see that you hardly get even half a glass of liquid.
Thank you, Ronnie. Robert, what can you say to that in terms of the glass and the ice taking up space?
Yeah, well, it obviously depends on the bar. I'm sure it changes from case to case. He was talked about the thicker bottom. I mean, the typical old-fashioned glass does have a thick bottom. The reason for that was because the sugar and the bitters used to be muddled at the bottom. And if you didn't have a thick bottom on that glass was going to shatter. So that style of glass has remained. I would guess that no matter what bar you're going into, you're probably getting, there's kind of a standard pour. Like if you're having an old fashioned, there is going to be 2 ounces of booze in there. And no matter how much ice is in the glass. So it may sometimes look like you're getting less than you should, but I think you're probably getting the same. I mean, it would be pretty chintzy to get like 1.5 ounces of whiskey or brandy in your old fashioned. Maybe some bars are trying to get away with that. And the more ice you put in there, if it's like that kind of cheap ice that you get from a lot of the ice machines, it dilutes the color and it looks lighter and lighter and lighter just because that ice is so translucent.
Ronnie, thank you for the call. I'm wondering, Robert, can you spend a moment here talking about cocktail bitters, what they are, how they're made, how you use them?
Yeah, bitters are kind of mysterious when you think about it. I refer to them as the salt and pepper of the cocktail world. They're just kind of like accents, spices. So what you have with bitters, and the most famous one is Angostura, which everyone probably has a bottle of at home lurking in their bar or in their cupboard somewhere. And so it's alcohol that has been steeped in various herbs and botanicals for a long time. So it takes on those flavors. And often that recipe is secret. Usually it has like anywhere from 20 to 40 ingredients. So you end up with this, I don't know, this thing that tastes like a million things, almost like, it usually often tastes like baking spices, but there are other kinds as well, like orange bitters. And that's what they are. And they may seem, it may seem like not a big deal to put like 1 or 2 dashes of these into a drink. And most famously, they go in an old fashioned, Angostura does, and Manhattans. But I encourage people out there, do an experiment. Create 2 Manhattans, one with bitters and one without bitters. You will notice a difference. The bitters really ties it all together.
Robert Simonson with us as we talk cocktails and what is modern classics. He's the author of a new book on modern cocktails. It's called Modern Classic Cocktails. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Caledonia. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I spent Saturday at a distillery near Winneconne, Wisconsin. And the family actually had an elk farm, and then years ago, about 10 years ago, their kids decided that they wanted to distill potatoes into vodka. One of the sons had an idea, and he created a new type of distillery where the liquid is goes over plates after plates after plates in a narrow tower, and it's distilled 124 times. So it gets rid of all the impurities, so there's basically no hangovers. It's called Pure, P-U-R-E, Class Vodka. You can check it on the internet. And then they've taken that same liquid and made it into moonshine, and gives it a bunch of different flavors. You know, they probably have like 20 different types of flavors that you can mix with cocktails and things. Very, very interesting.
Jack, thanks for bringing that. Robert, have you heard of this?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. In the last 10 to 15 years, I think there have been dozens of new distilleries in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin's not alone. Every state has new distilleries. And this, you can credit entirely to bartenders and the cocktail revival. These bartenders were hungry for new spirits, and they also wanted to know where the spirits were coming from. They're very interested in origins and authenticity. So I think distillers were encouraged by what was going on in cocktail bars, and they started all these craft distilleries.
What are good types of drinks to make if, say, I'm not necessarily buying the most top shelf liquor or perhaps making drinks on a budget? What would you suggest?
That's a good question. I would suggest making Manhattans. Manhattan is a very forgiving drink. It doesn't necessarily need the best bourbon or rye on the shelf. It's still going to taste pretty good. In the contrast, I would say a martini made with a cheap gin is not going to taste good. Margaritas can be very forgiving as well, because of the juice and the sugar that's in there. I would encourage people to have a tequila that's 100% agave. There are tequilas out there called mixtos, which are just like 50% agave, and the rest could be anything. It could be the kitchen sink. So those work. And Negronis also, gin, sweet vermouth, Campari. It's really hard to screw up a Negroni.
Let's spend a moment on the classic Manhattan cocktail. You write that it started with the Red Hook cocktail, invented by an Italian bartender based in Brooklyn in 2003. What made this variant so popular?
Many of the modern classic cocktails in the books are actually based on Manhattans. And you're right, it started with this one called the Red Hook. There was this very famous bar in New York called Milk and Honey. It was like the first neo speakeasy, and they took cocktails very seriously, and there was no menu. There was an Italian bartender that worked over there for a while named Enzo Errico, and he was playing around with Manhattan. He wanted to create a new version, so he created this version that had rye whiskey, that had Punta Mess, which is an Italian kind of vermouth, which wasn't known back then, and maraschino liqueur, which is a liqueur made from cherries in Italy. And it was a good cocktail, and people liked it, but its importance is that it inspired all his colleagues to create their own Manhattan variations. And they were all named after Brooklyn neighborhoods or Manhattan neighborhoods. There was a Little Italy, there was a Greenpoint, Cobble Hill, Carroll Gardens, just a million. And they all had rye whiskey, and then they had some other things. It just sort of showed that what you could do if you took an old classic and just changed it a little, you could create a modern classic. My wife and I, Enzo, the bartender, eventually moved back to Italy. He now has a bar on the island of Ischia. And my wife and I were traveling there this past summer, and we actually made the journey. We took a ferry to Ischia just to visit him. And have him make me a Red Hook cocktail. I wanted him at the hands of the inventor. And then I wrote about the whole story. I actually started a Substack newsletter this year, and I wrote the whole story of our journey to find the Red Hook.
How was that to drink it there with him? What went through you? What was that like?
Well, because I write about cocktails all the time and I think about this modern history, I have this little obsession where I want the famous new modern cocktails made for me by their inventors. So whenever I can find them, I track them down and ask them to make me this drink. Often they've moved on to bigger and better things. They own a bar or they work for a liquor company and they don't really bartend anymore. And so you have to persuade them to get behind the bar and say, just please, just once, you know. It was a great experience. Enzo was a great host. And you could see, you know, why he worked at Milk and Honey, why he was so respected, because he still took such great care, you know, with the ice, with the measuring out of the liquids, you know, just precision all the way, perfect glassware, perfect presentation. It was a great time.
Longtime cocktails journalist Robert Simonson, our guide to modern classic cocktails and helping us probe that central question of his new book, What Actually Makes a New Cocktail a Modern Classic? Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent with author Robert Simonson, who lays it out in his new book on cocktails. When everyone thinks your drink is an old standby, he writes, one created way back when by someone long dead, you know your drink has arrived. Robert's new book features dozens of modern classic cocktail recipes and the stories behind them. You can find a bunch at WPR.org/mornings. Let's go to Kim now in Eau Claire. Kim, what's on your mind about cocktails?
Well, this might be a little off topic. Good morning. But my grandfather had a still way back when it was prohibition, and it was hidden out in his garage. I was just wondering if the guest might know what he might have been brewing at that time.
So a still in the garage. Have you been able to see it firsthand, Kim? Any clues?
I never got to see it. I heard the story of they had a, you know what a two-holer is, that slid forward and it would contain the feces, and then there was a staircase that went down behind it, and he'd pull on the rope and it would close back up and he would be in a room underneath, and that's where the still was.
Wow. Robert, any thoughts on what the grandfather could have been making?
Well, my guess is he was probably making some kind of moonshine, but it all depends on what the raw material was. You know, if it was grain or potatoes, I doubt he was aging the spirit after he made it. So, you know, it would stay kind of like moonshine. But then again, if he was using, by any chance, grapes, he was ending up with some kind of unaged brandy. So it's hard to speculate.
Kim, thank you. Mike now in Lake Mills. Mike, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Also a little off topic. It is, I often hear that, I won't get a hangover if this drink is pure alcohol, as the impurities that cause hangovers. I wondered if the author had any opinion on that.
It's hangovers are a very mysterious thing, and they're also a very individual thing. You'll meet all kinds of people who won't drink a specific kind of spirit because they had a bad experience with it once upon a time. And I think that's rather subjective. You know, I mean, who can tell if one spirit affects a person worse than another? It's not really hangovers. I tend to study drinking. I haven't studied what happens the morning after as much.
Mike, thank you for the call. Robert, you say that the cocktail revival that you chronicled here really comes to an end around 2017. What was that turning point? Why was that?
Well, what happened where there were so many bartenders who had created literally thousands of drinks. Like I said earlier, if you're going to have a modern classic to continue, it's got to be pretty simple. So it became harder and harder to create a simple drink. There are still plenty of original drinks, but they're complicated, and they have 7 ingredients and special syrups and infusions. That drink's pretty much going to stay where it is, and it's not going to become world famous. And also, the revival did its job. I mean, the whole idea of the cocktail revival was to bring the cocktail, which is an American invention going back 200 years, to bring it back to respectability and have it be there at restaurants and bars along with wine, beer, and food as a part of the meal, a part of what we consume. And they accomplished that. Cocktails are back. Cocktails are taken seriously. There are bartenders who know how to make cocktails very well. So it's kind of like their work was done, and we're so used to it now that, you know, no revival goes on forever. It's got to end at some point. So that's just kind of like where I put the pin in it. There was actually an article that came out in 2017. It was in Thrillist, and the headline was, "We won the cocktail revolution. Now what?"
Sue called from Woodstock, Illinois, and said that their favorite drink is called Last Word. Sue says it has green chartreuse liqueur in it, and Sue is having a hard time finding it, wondering if you could talk about the shortage, perhaps?
A hard time finding the chartreuse?
Yeah, hard to find time, you know, yeah. Finding the drink, the Last Word, which Sue says has this green chartreuse liqueur in it.
Yes, it's an old sour from before Prohibition that was never famous, but it was brought back by the Seattle bartender named Murray Stenson, and now it's served everywhere. if she goes to a good cocktail bar, they should know how to make it. And even if they don't, it's only got four ingredients, so you just give the recipe. The problem with chartreuse, during the pandemic, there were supply chain issues with a lot of products, and we're still dealing with this. Certain liqueurs and ingredients that from Europe that we were used to getting easily are difficult to get, and I have heard that chartreuse is one of these. So what she may be encountering is that the bar, you know, they might want to make a last word, but they can't because they can't get an allocation of chartreuse.
What do you think is the most complicated mixed drink to get right?
Oh, wow. Gosh. That's a tough one. There is a drink called the Singapore Sling, which is fairly famous. It was invented in Singapore about a century ago. The problem was, and this is the problem with a lot of classic cocktails, is nobody knows what the original recipe was. So everybody has to guess. If you go to 10 bars and order a Singapore Sling, you're going to get 10 different drinks. And therefore, you don't know whether you're having a good one or not.
So it's really important to have the origins of the drink, the standard, in order to actually have a variation, in order to try to come up with your own. But, you know, if someone is trying their hand at inventing, quote, air quotes there, inventing a cocktail, do you have any tips for them? What kind of things should, you know, maybe never be mixed? And where can you go with that to try to just have your, you know, let yourself get a little creative?
Yeah, I would say start with a very simple cocktail. Start with a cocktail that you love. Say that you love martinis. And then just start making little adjustments, like instead of dry vermouth, maybe you'd want to use blanc vermouth, which is a white vermouth that is sweet. Or maybe you'd want to split the base liquor instead of just gin. You want to do like gin and vodka or something. But start with baby steps. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. And remember, it doesn't have to be completely different to be a new cocktail. It just has to be a little different.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Robert Simonson's new book is called Modern Classic Cocktails, 60 plus stories and recipes from the new golden age in drinks. And we have a bunch of those recipes. Go to WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.